and I had to teach all of a sudden. And so I just like made up a lesson. I didn't make up, but I just pulled a lesson out of the Bible of like, okay, I'm going to just like talk about God's creation. And I made hand motions on the fly. And in case you don't know, doing stuff, you only do stuff on the fly that you're really, really good at or okay at, or you're just really clueless at. So that was just really exciting to me. And this talk of God as creator, I have to briefly admit, is perhaps the smallest topic we could ever talk about. Because the God of who is the creator is the one who made the smallest little quarks. Do you know what a quark is? It's the thing that's a building block of a building block that's a building block that's a building block of a proton or an electron. They are so small. In fact, if you look up how small they are, you can read in parentheses, some scientists haven't confirmed that there are sizes this small yet. Sizes this small are theoretical. And people, the only people who think of these things are like crazy quantum physicists who really like know a bunch of math but don't know for sure if it works or not. At the same time, talking about a God who is creator, it's the biggest subject we could ever possibly talk about. We're talking about the God who made things like the Tarantula Nebula, or the Omega Cluster, or Barnard's Loop. Things, these stellar phenomenon that are almost larger than some galaxies in size. They are hundreds of thousands of light years just in terms of a nebula. And you're like, I didn't even know stuff existed that was that big. And I can't even wrap my mind around how small these things might be or how big these things might be. I can't wrap my mind around it. But all of these things are important to me. I think they're important to us because we happen to exist in this said creation that was made by our Creator. If you're here this morning, I'm going to hazard a vague guess that at some point in your life, you have had a thought, a mental musing, or had a short conversation with someone about what is God's power? How much power might that be? And there are a few different ways of talking about God's power that fuels all that we see and experience around us. A few favorites people like to use are like theoretical ways, right? One way is to talk about it through science and reason. And you can talk about math, you can talk about astronomy, and you can talk about quantum physics. Some folks like to talk about life sciences. Or if you're an evolution believer, talking about the great diversity and the great cycle of all the history of different things that have grown on our planet that we don't even know all of. And that is pretty wacky. And sometimes I'm quite thankful I didn't have to be around for any of that stuff. At the same time, folks might like to talk about the power of God purely in terms of like philosophizing or something. And there are, in fact, I've heard many like proofs or disproofs of God come up with by philosophically minded folk. In Sunday school growing up and throughout my years, I've definitely heard the question as it posed of, if God is all powerful, can God create a rock that God cannot lift? And of course, this is a paradox because if God can do anything, God can create a rock that God can't lift. But then God can't lift it, so God can't do something. So people go round and round and round, especially in children's Sunday school about this because they don't know how to use the word paradox. Just a couple of years ago, I had someone walk up to me and ask me about this this conundrum, and they found out I was a seminary person who thought a lot about God, kind of like all the time, maybe a little bit obsessively, possibly. And for the first time, I realized my response to this question about the unliftable rock problem, and I said, I don't care. I think there is better things to think about than the unliftable rock problem. I just think if you talk about that picture too long, it just doesn't make sense. And it doesn't really allow us to understand what God's power is and what God's character is of said power. These are questions about what is the raw potential of how much God's power might be, not what kind of power it is. There is another possibility, another way of talking about God's power, which is to talk about God's power through personal experiences. And when I first said that I'd tackle this sermon here on this morning, this is what I thought I'd talk about. As I talk about the power of God as creator, in particular, hanging out around creation, and me finding myself, I was way in over my head. I was totally about to die by the power of God's creation, and I was saying, oh God, help me out, 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 help me, help me out. And I have far too many stories about this. Enough that you might question my judgment as a person, or just in like having a brain. Like there's this one time I got charged by a badger, and thankfully at the last minute it took a right turn and went off into the woods. I was pretty thankful that the badger didn't totally charge at me, because that would be God's creation giving me, well, that wouldn't be good for me. There was also another time, this was also in Yellowstone on a similar hike, where I walked over a hill crest to find a grizzly bear and her family. and then the grizzly bear looked at me for a really long time and said, yeah, okay, you're all cool, and then started walking off, and then I continued on the trail, of course, because I didn't feel like I was worried about the grizzly bear anymore, only to crescent another hill to find the same grizzly bear and family there, and boy, that look was a long look. And we were like, should we go home now? Or maybe the many times I almost fell off a cliff, a glacier, or off the top of a mountain, or, you know, got drowned in a lake. I kind of have had a history of, I don't know how I'm here today, I'll just face it. God's power has a way of overwhelming me personally while in creation. It becomes very, very personal, not theoretical, very personal, very fast, when you realize that you are about to get rocked by the power of God in the midst of creation. But today, I want to talk about God in a different sense, than the science theory stuff. And as I got preparing for this sermon, I got more and more engrossed at what Psalm 65 has to say about God's power as reflected in creation. No matter what way you talk about God's power, there's one thing you can always come to. It's bigger. It's bigger than me, and I think it's bigger than each and every one of us here. It's kind of big. It's kind of a lot. It's a power that envelops our whole earth and envelops our whole human experience. In fact, I would categorize and understand this power as a power of abundance. That not a power that's just a drizzle, but that is a power that is more than that can be gathered, more that can be than it can be put together in a bucket. It is an abundance for you and abundance for me. It is an abundance of all creation. Psalm 65 starts by saying that God's power, first off, is abundant in God's presence and in God's redemption. That even though those who are gathered together in the assembly of God's name, even those who are gathered together in the congregation, even when there is sin, there is shame, there is brokenness, there's just wacky stuff going on, whether it's in our lives or in the lives of those we're connected to, that God's redemption is still working in all of our lives. That God's redemption is working in us and in our community. It is working in our assembly. We may have things we stumble over, but God's redemptive power is bigger than that. This abundance is a redemptive abundance. However much power God has, it is more than enough to reach through what is broken, to reach through broken circumstances. God has the power. God has the power of abundance in the midst of our lives and personal stories. And this is directly connected to the power of a God who is the creator of us all. The next three verses focus on God's power in establishing and maintaining all of creation, including the mountains. Okay, so you probably have figured out by now, I'm a mountains nerd. I love mountains. I think mountains are the best part of creation sometimes. I like to climb them. I like to get on top of them. I like to look at them. Uh, I, I get way into mountains. And this psalm claims that God established all of the mountains. Now, we might not have a brain for what that means for the Old Testament audience and the ancient Near East world, but in the ancient Near East, people generally believed that every mountaintop, that every summit was a temple to a particular god or spiritual being. That on the top of every one, that mountaintop was for a spiritual being of some kind, or what some people would call a god. And what the Old Testament is arguing here is that whatever you believe is on the top of those mountaintops, that God is the one who made all of those mountaintops. And that God not only made them, but that all of the holy places that you might encounter, all of the holy places of our earth were formed by God. Regardless of whether you think some spiritual thing is there or not, that God is the one who made those holy places. God is the one who calms the sea. God calms the chaos of our world. That he is the hope of the whole thing, not just parts of it, not just one little tiny corner or one tiny land, but all of this said creation. God didn't just make this creation and say, see ya, sayonara, bye. Instead, God sticks around in said creation all the time, is constantly and consistently working. Do you notice how the psalm says it makes note of the gates of the morning and the joys of the evenings? See, the ancient Hebrews believed that God didn't just make creation once, but that every night as the sun went away, that as the night progressed, that the power of God, the power of creation, was working and recreating, kind of like that God had as a nighttime janitorial crew, bringing repairs to that which is damaged in creation. That God is actively recreating every day. Every morning, that this creation is renewed afresh. That you can experience it in a new way. Got things up. This is the power of a sustained creation. It's not something done once, it's done continually. It is a God who is a sustainer. And I think this promise of a sustained creation is also a promise of a resurrection. It is a promise of a recreation happening as well. And as people of Jesus, I think this is where a lot of our hope lies. Our hope lies that this creation will come a day of recreation. We'll be given anew. Finally, this psalm speaks of what perhaps is God's presence and maybe one of the most practical ways. It closes in speaking of God's abundance, in particular by providing the resources that generate food, which is kind of important. And we might take this for granted because we're kind of, I don't know, most of us in here aren't really agrarian folk. Have you seen my garden? I'm not a very good gardener. As much as I'd love to be a great gardener, I'm not one. I'm not an agrarian person. Maybe someday, but not today. The psalm highlights God's power in bringing the rain, to bring the water that quenches the thirst of us and quenches the thirst of our land. It's only this time of year that we begin to realize how much we kind of like having rain every once in a while in Portland. But yet this rain, this quenching of water, is vital for our lives. Not just for the growing of food, but every ecosystem that I know of depends on precipitation in some form at some point of its life cycle. Even deserts at some point need water. How do you think the cacti got their water? It had to rain at some point. And these agrarian folk of the Old Testament knew that when the rains came, that the blessing of the Lord rained down upon them. The blessing of the Lord rained down upon them, giving them life and giving them an abundance of goods and food for their entire communities. Through such rain, the abundant power of God is made revealed. It is the power that sustains all life and sustains our lives. It is the power that sustains our earth. It's the power of God, the power of abundance that gives life this earth every day. I said that wrong. Don't pay attention to that too much. So we may experience the great community of this relation. Now, I'm going to start throwing in some nuances here. I think it's worth knowing that God's power in creation is a power of abundance. It is a whole creation that is fruitful and multiplies. Oddly enough, God's creation does not produce such that every single person here or every single person in the world can have an infinite amount of whatever good they want, correct? Who do you know who gets an infinite amount of food every day? Every day you get an infinite amount of steak. Well, that sounds kind of nice. The earth doesn't produce that. It doesn't produce an infinite amount for one person. It might produce an abundance for a community or abundance for one person, but it doesn't produce an infinite amount. It produces so that there is enough. It's an abundance of enoughness for each and every one of us. It is an abundance of enoughness for our community and an abundance of enoughness for our ecosystems. So I'm going to guess up until this point, you've been like totally with me. You've been like, he's not saying anything really new, whatever. I've probably thought about this before. I can read this in my Bible easily enough. But this is the point in the sermon where I'm going to take a right turn that I don't think most of you are going to have expected. And I hope that you guys will stay with me. Some of you may choose that I need to have a talking to after church today. And if so, then we can talk about it. Don't worry. But what I'm going to suggest here is the work of several biblical scholars, and it's called food fight theology. One of the proponents is a guy named Walter Brueggemann, who's one of the leading Old Testament theologians in America. What I have to say is this. Even though God's power in creation is indeed powerful and it is indeed abundance, we have the ability, humans have the ability, if we choose, to threaten or diminish God's power in our world. What I mean is this. We humans have the right, we have the power to disrupt the activity and the purpose of God's power. We do this in particular when we hoard or acquire God's abundance for ourselves. When we take goods that this creation produces and we go mine, 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 mine. And in particular, when we go mine, 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 when it's more than enough for us and we use that to lord or to get power over others. This is built out of anxiety. It's built out of scarcity thinking. And it's built out of a need for power. It's a need for an unending hunger. And this is what threatens God's abundance. And right now you're saying, well, Evan, where the heck do you get that in your Bible? I'm going to have a couple of examples for you. First, the symbol for a person who hungers for grabbing God's abundance for himself is Pharaoh. Pharaoh in the first two books of the Bible. When we first meet the character of Pharaoh, it's in Genesis 13. Right after Abram comes onto stage. And it turns out that Abram in his land is experiencing a famine. So he goes to this place where him and everyone knows that they're going to be able to go and get some kind of food so they can live. Where do they go? Abram and Sarah go to Egypt. And they go there, they get some food, and immediately Pharaoh figures that he is entitled to this beautiful woman named Sarah. He is entitled to have Abram's wife. How does he get this entitlement? Because everyone went to the place where they know someone has power and someone has food. Frequently, when people act out of this scarcity, this grabbing for food and for goods, this grabbing that doesn't rely on God's abundance, this grabbing that doesn't see God's abundance, frequently, women and people are other people, like lower on the social food chain, quickly are those the people who get hurt, who get used as pawns, who get dehumanized, who are treated as less than or having less worth. This is what threatens God's abundance. This is what threatens God's power. When Pharaoh later on brings the people of Israel into slavery, he uses them to do his dirty work. He uses them to build his own storehouses of food. And he uses them to make bricks, which is like really hard, nasty work. They don't have any fancy machinery, so they have to do it all by hand. This was like the heaviest, heaviest grunt work that you could do in the land of Egypt. Pharaoh is a person who lives out of this anxiety and need for grabbing and hoarding God's abundance. The way you threaten him is by threatening what his hoarding of God's power and God's abundance. Unfortunately, it doesn't work out for Pharaoh. There's a little bit of a long drama that happens in Exodus at one point. But the people of Israel, in fact, they are hooked on Pharaoh's way of thinking. So when they get out into the wilderness, they go, oh no, how are we going to eat? Pharaoh had all this food for us to eat that he was holding up for himself, and he'd have to give us a little bit. So God invests a new plan. God invents an idea for Israel to experience God's abundance in an entirely new way, God's power in an entirely new way. The people of Israel get this really cool magic bread. It's magic bread that comes every day. And it's magic bread that comes so that everyone in the community, everyone in the people in the land of Israel can have some, can have a little bit more than enough of what they need every day. Now, there's some funny, interesting things about this magic bread. This magic bread spoils really, really fast. In fact, it's unhoardable magic bread. You can't just like hoard up an infinite amount just for yourself. No, this magic bread is a magic bread that's meant to be shared with the entire community. It's not for someone to hold up in anxiety and store and lord over someone else. This is an idea of what the Lord's abundance is. The Lord's abundance isn't something to be hoarded, but it's something to be given to one another, like the charis, like the gift of God's Spirit. Now, it's easy enough to say that trope, Pharaoh fella's bad enough. You're like, come on, Pharaoh's supposed to be a jerk in the Bible. That's the point of what Pharaoh's character's supposed to be. Unfortunately, this scarcity, anxiety grabbing, this grabbing and hoarding of God's abundance and God's power is something that lands itself and finds itself in the history and in the story of the people of Israel. In Deuteronomy, there are instructions about the idea of having a king. And do you know what those instructions have? It says, and this king is not to get together a great army of horses for himself, or make the people go back into Egypt to get horses for himself. Because the Lord has said, you will never again go back that way. And he is not to have a great number of wives for fear that his heart may be turned away, or great wealth for silver and gold. That the leader of the people of God is not supposed to hunger or work out of this scarcity anxiety thinking. They aren't supposed to grab and hoard a lot of things for themselves, because this would lead all of the people of God into this same thinking, this same way of working in the world. These instructions in Deuteronomy 17 are almost verbatim quoted later on, a couple of books later, by Samuel. It turns out there's a bunch of people who walk up in front of Samuel's door and say, hey, we want a king because we want to be cool and trendy like everyone else. How does this work? Samuel turns to these people wanting a chieftain, wanting a king, and he says, this is the sort of king who will be your ruler. He will take your sons, and they will make them his servants, his horsemen, and drivers of war carriages, and they will go running before his war carriages. And he will make them captains of thousands and fifties. And he will put some of them to work plowing and cutting his grain, and making his instruments of war, and building his war carriages. Your daughters he will take to be makers of perfumes and cooks and bread makers. He will take your fields and your wine gardens and your olive gardens and all of the best of them. He will give them to his servants. He will take a tenth of your seed and of your and the fruit of your vines and give it to his servants. He will take your men servants and your servant girls and the best of your oxen and your, this says a word I'm not supposed to say in church, your donkeys, and put them in, and put them to his work. He will take a tenth of your sheep, and they will be his servants. Then you will be crying out because your king, who you have taken for yourselves, but the Lord will not give you an answer on that day. So what did the people of Israel do when they heard this great speech from Samuel, from the prophet Samuel? They say, but that's still not cool enough. We want to have someone who's a king anyway. This thinking of wanting to have someone that hoards or grabs of God's abundance is enlivened in and lives in human societies and human thinking. Frequently, we find ourselves not thinking about someone who's hoarding God's power for themselves and how that might negatively affect others. And this is what happened in the history of the people of Israel. Solomon, one of the king after David, did this very thing. He hoarded tons of food and gold and wives just for himself. He hoarded all these things, threatening God's power. The amount of Solomon's food for one day was 30 measures of crushed grain and 60 measures of meal. Okay, hold on. How much is 30 measures and 60 measures? This is like way old way of calculating and measuring counts. How do I know that that's just like not 2 milligrams each? I had to look it up. It says, every day Solomon needed 5,000 liters, 5,000 liters of fine flour and 10,000 liters. What? 10,000 liters of coarsely grown flour. He needed 5,000 and 10,000 liters of the best flour in the land so he could make all the best bread for him and his court. It even goes on. He needed 10 fat oxen and 20 oxen from the fields and 100 sheep. This is what he needed every day, 100 sheep every day. In addition to harts and gazelles and roes and fat fowls. That is a lot of meat for even one person to eat one day. I am an avid meat eater. I cannot eat that much. I can't even host a party that would eat that much. It would be crazy. That would be more than any of us, and then all of us could eat in a day on a Sunday morning. We wouldn't make it through an oxen. I think we could make it through a sheep. But we definitely couldn't make it through 100 sheep, could we not? This is the kind of thinking that happens when you're working out of scarcity, out of anxiety, out of hoarding God's power and God's abundance for oneself. This works against God's power. And in the biblical tradition, all of the prophets, every single one of them, railed, had almost very long strings of cuss words and used metaphors of how this was really bad for the people of God. All the time. They thought this because they thought it threatened God's power. Even the greatest of the kings of Israel did this very thing. Even David did it. In 2 Samuel 24, David takes a census. He takes a census to find every person in the land, every male that would make an adequate warrior. That would make an adequate warrior to figure out how much money, how much stuff he could get in his next war. How much stuff he could get for his great riches and kingdom. Not for his people, but for himself. And a prophet comes before him having a vision from the Lord and said, oh, no, 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 no. David, this is what God has not called you to. God has called you to fall before him in his power of abundance. Not the power for yourself. This is a theme of what all the biblical prophets advocated for. And this is what Jesus advocated to himself. This God's power is an abundance of power. It's an abundance for all. Not an abundance of the one. It's not an abundance that's just for me. It's not just for you. It's an abundance for all. Think about this. Jesus' harshest teachings, who were Jesus' harshest teachings pointed toward? They were pointed at the Pharisees, but even more than that, they were pointed at the rich. Jesus' harshest teachings, everyone. What's it say about the camel and the eye of a needle? It says it would be easier for a camel to go through the eye of the needle than a rich person to enter the kingdom of God. Why is this? It is because God's kingdom is not a kingdom that's built on this hoarding and this scarcity. It's a kingdom for all. It's a kingdom of a power that is in abundance, a grace that is in abundance. Do you have to have certain financial records in order to make it to the kingdom of God? No, we take everybody. It's awesome. You don't have to put in a college application. We take everyone in the kingdom of God because we believe that God's grace is enough for you. That God's grace, there's enough abundance of God's grace and God's giving that all of us can partake in this grace, that all of us can partake in this kingdom. You don't share the gospel by hoarding it for yourself, do you? You don't say, well, I have the gospel and you don't. I have the gospel, you don't. No, that's not what we are called to do. We are called to share, to give in this abundance of God's grace that we have received. This is the same thing with spiritual gifts. Am I supposed to sit here with my spiritual gift and say, ooh, I have it, you don't? Or I'm just going to hold it up and keep it all for myself? My precious, you're sounding a little bit like Gollum from Lord of the Rings, who hoards something for himself and tries to hide it. This is not the way of spiritual gifts. This is not the way of God's grace. Spiritual gifts are to be given to one another, and this is God's economy. It's an abundance for all, an abundance for all of God's creation. This is what God calls us to today. For a final applied point, I'm going to touch on something that's really, really tough. It's that we live in a world where there is more than enough food for everyone. There's a couple times more than enough food for everyone, not just in the United States, but worldwide. Yet, why is it that there's a football stadium worth of children who die every day from starvation? Why? Because people, I'm not pointing at you, I'm just pointing at our world, and say that we live in a world that threatens God's abundance. That there are people who hoard for themselves, that grab for themselves, and they threaten and diminish God's power in the world. Because there are people, there are children who can be provided for every day, yet we do not. The cost in dollars to make sure that every person who does not have food has sufficient food for this year is approximately $30 billion. That's a lot more money than I have. I'm guessing it's a lot more money than you have. It's a lot more money than a lot of people have. Yet, it's a rather insignificant amount of money compared to the amount of money that the United States or several other nations spent on military and defense spending, that many of us spend on power in order to hold things for ourselves. Do you think that this is the way of God's power and God's abundance in our world? I tell you, to experience God's power, in order to experience God's abundance, you must give it. That God has more than enough abundance and more than enough grace for you. There's more than enough grace for me. And the only way to experience this, well, okay, if you don't want to experience, how about I say it this way? If you don't want to experience this love, if you don't want to experience this abundance, hold it. Grab onto it for yourself. Have tons of anxiety about it. Worry over it. Instead, what I offer you today is to take hold and to let go. Let go of the abundance that God has for you. And you will find that there is more than you could ever need. What is God calling you to share? Do you have a gift that you can share, a spiritual gift? Do you have some goods, some physical things in your life that you can share with others? How are you called to partake, to live in the great, awesome power of God's abundance this morning? Amen.